Chapter 8 God's Omnipresent Power. The following day I received a communication through which I became engaged in a business activity that required all my time and attention. The mere anticipation of it gave me great joy, and I entered in with much enthusiasm. There came a refreshing, quickening sense, a thing I had never before known in my business experience. In the course of its progress, I came into close personal contact with a man of very dominating character. His entire attitude in business was to gain his desire by force if intrigue failed or he was opposed in any way. He believed only in the power of his own intellect and human will, and had neither knowledge of nor faith in anything else. At no time did he hesitate to crush or ruin persons or things that stood in the way of his success, and used all means to gain his own selfish ends. I had met him some 3 years before the following experience took place, and at that time had felt almost helpless in his presence, so overpowering was the feeling of domination he continually sent out. Yet I knew, in spite of my own reaction to him, that his control over others was only force, focused into the outer activity. I was somewhat disturbed, as I realized I would have to associate with him. Immediately, I sought a way to deal with him by application of the God law, when the inner voice said to me clearly, "Why not let the mighty God within take full charge and handle this condition? That inner power knows no domination, and is always invincible." I was immensely grateful and completely released everything into its management. I met this man with two others and agreed to go with them to inspect a mining property in a distant state. I felt it to be a very valuable one. The owner was an elderly lady whose good husband had passed on by an accident in the mine some months before. He had left things in a precarious condition, and our dominating friend had determined to buy the mine at his own price, not an honest one. After a long trip by auto, we reached our destination about 2 o'clock the second day. We met the owner, whom I realized was a blessed soul, true and honorable. Then and there, I took the determined stand that she should have a square deal and receive full value for the property. She invited us to a lovely luncheon, and we proceeded to examine the mine. We went through the workings, tunnels, drifts, shafts, and stopings. The more I watched, the more certain I became that something was wrong. The very atmosphere seemed to breathe it to me. I was certain a rich strike had been made which had not been reported to the owner. I somehow knew the buyer had secretly placed one of the workmen on duty to watch for such an activity, and that during the weeks of watching he had gained the confidence of the superintendent. I realized at heart the superintendent was a good man, but not awakened, spiritually speaking. As we stood talking to him, my God-self disclosed fully what had occurred. A short time previously, as these two were on their inspection of the work, they had come to a spot where the shots had broken into the face of a tunnel, leading directly into the heart of the mountain. The blast had broken into a very rich vein of gold-bearing quartz. The superintendent was about to rush out and report it to the owner when the spying workman remarked, "Wait, I know the man who is going to buy this mine. If you want to continue in your present position, don't mention that strike. I'll see to it. You not only stay here as superintendent, but there'll be $5,000 in it for you. The old lady'll get enough to keep her anyway." The superintendent, fearing the loss of his position, had agreed. In our examination of the mine, we came to the end of the main tunnel, and I felt strongly this was the place the rich strike had been made. It had been cleverly covered up and disguised as a loose formation where it was dangerous to work. Such was the report they had made to the woman who owned the mine. As I stood at this place talking with the others, My inner sight was opened, and I saw all that had taken place. The rich strike, the covering of it, the offer to the superintendent, and his acceptance. I was grateful to have my feeling verified, but knew I must wait. We returned to the owner's residence, and negotiations began. The buyer opened the subject by saying, "Mrs. Atherton, what do you expect for this property?" "I am holding it at $250,000, she replied courteously and gently. "Absurd," he shouted. "Preposterous, ridiculous. Not worth half that amount." He carried on in this vein for some few moments, blustering as was his habit. It had worked many times before, and he was still following the old line of procedure. He argued and stormed, and ended by saying, "Mrs. Atherton, you are in a position where you must sell. I will be generous and give you $150,000. "I will consider it," she replied, so cowed by his attitude of domination and bluster that she began to accept his ideas and give in to his arrogant impudence. He saw her waver and immediately began to high-pressure the whole situation. "I cannot wait," he went on. "My time is valuable. You must decide at once or the deal is off." He drew the papers from his pocket and placed them on the table. Mrs. Atherton looked about helplessly, and I shook my head no to her, but she did not see me. The contract lay open, and she stepped across the room, taking a chair at the table, preparing to sign. I knew if she were to be protected, I must act at once. And going to where she sat, I addressed our dominating friend. "Just a moment," I said. "You will pay this dear lady what her mine is worth, or you are not going to get it." He turned his wrath upon me with several very pungent invectives and attempted the same tactics as usual. "I'd like to know who's going to prevent me having the mine at my price," he retorted. I felt a surge of the mighty God power within come forth like an avalanche, keeping me unaffected by his tirade of vindictiveness, and I replied, "God will prevent you." With that answer, he burst out laughing, carried on boisterously, cynically, insultingly. I waited calmly. "You fool," he began again in another tirade of anger. "You prate about God. Not you, nor God, nor anything can stop me. I get what I go after, and I get it regardless. No one has ever stopped me yet." His arrogance seemed to have no limit, and he revealed himself, mind and body, as the victim of his emotions. His reason was unable to function, as it is always the case, under any uncontrolled feeling, or it would have warned him to go no further with his insults. I felt the expansion of the God power again. This time it came stronger and stronger, until, in a tone like a clarion, the mighty inner voice of my God self revealed the truth of the whole transaction and the deception at the mine. "Mrs. Atherton," I said, "there has been gross deceit practiced upon you. Your workmen made a rich strike. This man had a spy among them who has bribed your superintendent to remain silent concerning it." The superintendent and the others in the room went white and speechless as my inner self continued to expose their treachery. The prospective buyer seemed equal to any emergency and interrupted me in his wild anger, shouted, "You lie! I'll brain you for such interference." He lifted his steel cane, and as I raised my hand to seize it, a white flame suddenly shot forth, flashing full in his face. He dropped to the floor as if struck by lightning. Then my mighty God self spoke again, with all authority of eternity, majestic, powerful. "Let no one in this room move until given permission." My outer self, no longer me, but God in action, stepped to where the man lay and went on. "Great soul in this man, I speak to you. Too long have you been held prisoner by his dominating personal self. Come forth now. Take command of his mind and body. Right the many deceptions he has practiced in the present life. Within the hour, This strong outer human creation of discord and injustice which he has built up shall be consumed, and never again shall it deceive or humanly dominate another of God's children. To the outer self I say, awaken in peace, love, kindliness, generosity, and goodwill to all that lives. Slowly, color began to come back into the man's face, and he opened his eyes in strange bewilderment. God in me, still in charge, took him gently by the hand, and putting an arm under his shoulder, helped him to a large easy chair. Again it commanded, "My brother, look at me." As he raised his eyes to mine, a tremor passed over his body, and in a voice scarcely audible, said, "Yes, I have seen. I understand how wrong I have been. God forgive me." He dropped his head in his hands and hid his face, silent and ashamed. Tears began to drop through his fingers, and he wept like a child. "You will pay this dear lady $1,000,000, my God self continued, and give her a 10% interest in the mind also, for in the strike recently made is at least $10,000,000 in gold ore." With deep humility and a strange sweetness, he answered, "Let it be done now." He requested his men this time, instead of ordering them, as was his former habit, to draw up the papers as had been directed. Mrs. Atherton and he both signed, completing the transaction. I turned to the others in the room and realized from the expression on their faces, all of them had been so lifted in consciousness, they had seen beyond the human veil, each of them saying, "Never, so help me God, will I ever attempt to deceive or do wrong to my fellow man again." They had been raised to fully recognize and accept the God self within every one. It was late afternoon when this occurrence took place. Mrs. Atherton extended a cordial invitation to remain as her guests overnight and accompany her to Phoenix in the morning for the recording of the papers for the sale. After dinner that night, we gathered in the big living room before a large open fireplace. Everyone sincerely sought more understanding of the great cosmic laws of life. They asked how it happened I had come into this kind of knowledge, and I told them of the Master, Saint Germain, and the way I had met him. I related some of my experiences on Mount Shasta, and how in the course of our conversation in regard to the great cosmic law he had said, "My son, the great cosmic law does not discriminate any more than does the multiplication table. If one makes a mistake in its application, or electricity, when one who is ignorant of the law governing its use tries to direct its force without knowledge of the way to control it. The great immutable decrees which forever keep order in the infinite realm of manifested life are all based upon the one great principle of creation, love. That is the heart, the source of all, and the very hub upon which existence in form takes place. Love is harmony, and without it, in the beginning of a form, that form could not come into existence at all. Love is the cohesive power of the universe, and without it, a universe could not be. In your scientific world, love expresses itself as the attractive force between the electrons. It is the directive intelligence which wills them into form, the power which keeps them whirling around a central core, and the breath within the core that draws them to it. The same thing is true of each vortex of force everywhere in creation, a central core, and the electrons whirling around it form an atom. This core of love is to the atom what the magnetic pole is to the earth, and what the spine is to the human body. Without a central core or heart center, there is only the unformed universal light, the electrons filling infinity and whirling around the great central sun. The electron is pure spirit, or light of God. It remains forever uncontaminated and perfect. It is eternally self-sustained, indestructible, self-luminous, and intelligent. If it were not, it could not and would not obey the law, the directing activity of love. It is immortal, ever pure, intelligent, light energy, and the only real, true substance out of which everything in the universe is made, the eternally perfect life essence of God. Interstellar space is filled with this pure light essence. It is not dark and in chaos, as has been the ignorant, limited concept of puny human intellects. This great sea of universal light that exists everywhere throughout infinity is constantly being drawn into form and given a quality of one kind or another, according to the way the electrons are held around a central point or core by love. The number of electrons which combine with each other in a specific atom is the result of and determined by conscious thought. The rate at which they whirl around the central core is the result of and determined by feeling. The intensity of the drawing and whirling motion within the central core is the breath of God, and therefore the most concentrated activity of divine love. Speaking in scientific terms, it would be called centripetal force. These are the determining factors which make the quality of an atom. Thus, you will see the atom is an entity, a living, breathing thing created or brought into existence by the breath, the love of God, through the will of the self-conscious intelligence. In this way, the Word is made flesh. The machinery that self-conscious intelligence uses to accomplish this manifestation of its being is thought and feeling. Destructive thought and discordant feeling so rearrange the ratio and rate and speed of the electrons within the atom that the duration of the breath of God within the pole is changed. The duration of the breath is decreed by the will of the consciousness using that particular kind of atom. If that conscious directing will is withdrawn, the electrons lose their polarity and fly apart, seeking their way back intelligently, mind you, to the great central sun, repolarizing themselves. There they receive love only. The breath of God is never-ending, and order, the first law, is eternally maintained. Some scientists have claimed and taught that planets collide in space. No such thing is possible. To do so would be to throw the entire plan of creation into chaos. It really is fortunate indeed that the mighty laws of God are not limited to the opinions of some of the children of Earth. It does not matter what any scientist, mundane or otherwise, thinks. God creation is ever moving forward and expressing more and more perfection. The constructive thought and harmonious feeling within a human mind and body are the activities of love and order. These permit the perfect ratio and speed of the electrons within the atom to remain permanent, and thus they stay polarized at their particular point in the universe as long as the duration of the breath of God within their core is held steady by the will of the directing self-conscious intelligence using the body in which they exist. In this way, the quality of perfection and the maintenance of life in a human body is always under the conscious control of the will of the individual occupying it. The will of the individual is supreme over his temple, and even in cases of accident, no one leaves his body temple until he wills to do so. Very often, pain in the body, fear, uncertainty, and many other things influence the personality to change its decisions concerning what it has willed in the past. But everything that happens to the body is and will always be under the control of the individual's free will. To understand the above explanation concerning the electron and the conscious control the individual has through his thought and feeling, to govern the atomic structure of his own body is to understand the one principle governing form throughout infinity. When man will make the effort to prove this to himself, or within his own atomic flesh body, he will then proceed to master himself. When he has done that, all else in the universe is his willing co-worker to accomplish whatsoever he wills through love. Whoever makes himself willingly obedient under the law of love has perfection in his mind and world permanently maintained. Under him and him alone does all authority and mastery belong. He only has the right to rule because he has first learned to obey. When he has obtained obedience from the atomic structure within his own mind and body, all atomic structure outside of his mind and body will obey him also. Thus, mankind, through thought and feeling, has the power, each individual within himself, to rise to the highest or sink to the lowest. Each one alone determines his own pathway of experience. By conscious control of his attention as to what he allows his mind to accept, he can walk and talk with God face to face, or looking away from God become lower than the animals, sinking his human consciousness into oblivion. In the latter case, God flame within him then withdraws from its human habitation. After aeons of time, it tries a human journey once again into the world of physical matter, until final victory is accomplished consciously and of its own free will. I told them of the limitless possibilities which Saint Germain had shown me were before mankind for accomplishment, whenever it is willing to accept the great God presence within every individual as the directing and accomplishing power. The buyer of the mine asked me why I used the word acceptance so often, and I recalled the word Saint Germain had used in explaining it to me, for he said, "Even in the outer activity of your life, if you purchase a thing or are offered something marvelous and perfect, if you do not accept it, it would be impossible for you to use or have the benefit from it. So it is with the great God presence within us. Unless we accept that our life is God life, and that all power and energy we have with which to do anything is God power and God energy, how can we have God qualities and accomplishment in our world? As sons of God, we are commanded to choose whom we shall serve, the mighty presence of God within us, or the outer human self. The gratification of the outer human appetites and sense demands has one and only one result, misery and destruction. All constructive desire is really the God self within pushing perfection forward into the use and enjoyment of the outer self. The great energy of life is flowing through us constantly. If we direct it to constructive accomplishment, it brings joy and happiness. Directed to sense gratification, there cannot be anything but misery as a result, because it is all the action of law, an impersonal life energy. Keep before the outer activity of your mind the constant reminder that you are life, God in action in you and your world. The personal self is continually claiming things and power of its own, when the very energy by which it exists is loaned it by the God self. The outer personal human activity does not even own its skin. The very atoms of its body are loaned to it by the supreme God presence from the great sea of universal substance. Train yourself to return all power and authority to the great glorious God flame which is your real self and the source from which you have always received every good thing. We talked until 2 o'clock in the morning, and then I had to suggest we retire. No one wanted to sleep, but I said to them, "You will sleep in the arms of God." And the next morning, they were surprised to realize how quickly they had dropped off to sleep. We were up at 7 and on our way to Phoenix. The recording was completed, and I explained I must leave as my work with them was finished for the time being. They were all deeply grateful and anxious to know more. I promised to keep in touch with them and give further help as the Master Saint Germain should direct. As I was leaving, the buyer of the mine turned to me and said, "I don't care what anyone thinks of me. I want to embrace you and thank you from the bottom of my heart for saving me from the ruin of my outer self and for revealing the great light." I bowed my head in deep humility and replied, "Thank God, I am but the channel. God alone is the great presence and power that does all things well." Mrs. Atherton turned to me and expressed her feeling. "I do praise and thank the God in you for the mighty protecting presence, and never in my life shall I cease to thank God and you for the light this experience has brought us all." "I feel certain we shall all meet again," I replied, and bidding everyone goodbye, turned my face once more toward Mount Shasta, arriving at my lodge the evening of the second day. 2 weeks later, I felt a strong impulse to make one more trip to my trysting place with the Master, Saint Germain. I started at 4 a.m. and reached the edge of the dense timber about 9. The plaintive cry of my panther friend came to my ears before I had gone 20 paces into the woods. I answered quickly. In a moment it came bounding to my side with all the welcome of an old-time friend, and we proceeded onward to our meeting place. I noticed the panther was very restless and acted as if laboring under some inner agitation. This was most unusual, for it had always been very quiet when in my presence. I patted and stroked the beautiful head, but it made no difference. I sat down, and we ate lunch. "Come on, old boy," I said as we finished. "Let's go for a walk." It gave me a long, steady look, the most pathetic expression I've ever seen. I could not understand it. We had gone some distance when we came to a cliff about 15 feet high, at the top of which hung a projecting rock. Something caused me to look at the panther. The expression in his eyes was wild and fierce. I sensed a sort of tension in the atmosphere, but did not realize what it was. I walked on a few paces farther and felt a chill pass over me. Looking up suddenly, I saw a mountain lion crouched, ready to spring. The next instant, it leaped toward me. I threw myself against the wall, and the lion landed beyond where I had stood. Like a flash of lightning, the panther sprang, and the two locked in mortal combat. No words can describe the terror of the struggle that followed. They screamed, rolled, tore, and clawed each other. Lion was considerably heavier, and it seemed for a time as if it would gain the advantage. However, the panther was the faster moving of the two, and finally broke away. There was just an instant's pause until it saw a chance, and then with one spring landed on the lion's back and fastened its teeth just behind the ears. The panther's grip was like steel, and after a few seconds of rolling and twisting, the lion's struggles grew weaker. Finally, they ceased altogether. The panther came reeling toward me, its side terribly torn. It looked up at me, all the fierceness gone from its eyes, and its energy ebbing fast. There passed an expression of contentment over the face, and suddenly, giving a plaintive cry, it fell over dead at my feet. I stood motionless and wept silently at the loss of my friend, for I had become almost as attached to it as to a human companion. The next instant I looked up, and beside me stood Saint Germain. "My beloved brother, be not sad or dismayed," he said. "Your contact with the panther had so quickened its consciousness that it could no longer remain in that present body, and the great cosmic law demanded from it some service to you. This it gave in love by saving your life. All is truly well. He touched the thumb of his right hand to my forehead. Be at peace, he continued, as the feeling of grief left me, and I felt completely relieved. The great cosmic law is unerring. We cannot receive without giving, and we cannot give without receiving. Thus the great balance of life is maintained. I congratulate you sincerely on the service rendered at the mine, and your serenity during the occurrence. All concerned with that transaction will become great helpers to humanity. Soon, you will be called upon to render a far greater service than any you have given so far. In it, remember always, it is God's power and intelligence acting, and your mind and body only the channel. Until you meet with this experience, meditate constantly upon the limitless power of God, which can express through you at any time. I asked him what the Ascended Master's attitude is in regard to the many channels through whom partial truth is given forth, and he replied, "There are many sincere channels. Some have more understanding than others. All are God's children, serving to the best of their ability with the understanding they have at present. We may not judge anyone, but we must know and see only God expressing in all. Our endeavor is to bless all activity wherever it is. We see the inner light radiating through such activities, and this makes it impossible for us to be mistaken as to whether they are or are not giving forth truth. It is the same with individuals. Those who offer their service in the name of the ascended Jesus Christ will always receive more than ordinary sustaining power." We had walked some distance when he said, "Come, I will accompany you home. Place your arm about my shoulder." I did so, and felt my body lifted from the ground. In a few moments more, I was in my room at the lodge with Saint Germain, standing beside me, smiling at my surprise. "Meet me in 7 days," he said, "at our appointed place, for then we will finish our work in this part of the country." He smiled, bowed graciously, and slowly faded from sight. The last thing that remained visible as he gradually disappeared were his marvelous, beautiful eyes smiling back at me. As I meditated each day upon the great God presence within for my coming service, I realized more and more how important it is to keep the attention focused upon that presence only, no matter what appearances seem to indicate, in order to keep any outer condition from affecting me. In one of Saint Germain's conversations, he had stressed particularly the all-importance of keeping my outer self harmonious, and in regard to this had said, "My son, you cannot realize how very great is the necessity for harmony in the outer self if the fullness of the inner perfection and power is to be expressed in your outer life. The importance of keeping a feeling of peace, love and serenity in the personal self cannot be emphasized too strongly, for when this is done, the mighty God presence within can act without limit in an instant. The continual outpouring of a feeling of peace and divine love to every person and everything unconditionally, no matter whether you think it be deserved or not, is the magic key that unlocks the door and releases instantly this tremendous inner God power. Fortunate indeed is he who has learned this law, for he then seeks to be all peace and love. Without it, humanity has nothing good, and with it they have all things perfect. Harmony is the keynote, the one great law of life. Upon it rests all perfect manifestation, and without it all form disintegrates and returns into the great sea of universal light. The following 7 days, I spent much time in meditation. I felt a greater and greater peace growing within me, until by the 6th day, it seemed as if my entire consciousness were like a great calm sea. On the morning of the 7th day, I left my lodge at 4 o'clock and reached our meeting place at 10:30. I sat down on a log to wait with a feeling of wonderful exhilaration, which I knew to be the result of my meditation. I was so deep within the contemplation of my God-self, I did not hear anyone approaching until a voice spoke to me. I looked up and saw an old man with white hair and beard, whom I thought at first sight was an old prospector, although his clothing was too clean for that occupation. As he came up to me and held out his hand, that too confirmed my feeling. He was not a laboring man. We exchanged greetings, chatted for a few moments on generalities. Then he turned to me and said, "My friend, I would like to tell you a story. It won't take long. I haven't told it to anyone for a long time. I would like to try once more." By that time, I began to have a feeling of intense interest. It occurred to me he might be thirsty, and as I reached for a cup to get him a drink from the spring by which we stood, a crystal cup formed within my hand, like the one Saint Germain had held out to me several times. The old man looked up, and with eyes shining and excited, almost shouted, "It is he! It is he!" I did not know what to do, so I insisted he drink. As I looked within the cup, I saw it was filled with the same clear, sparkling liquid the master had given me. The old man grasped it eagerly, and with an intense expression of the deepest gratitude I have ever seen, drank the contents. He immediately became very calm and quiet, but with it all a deep, intense sincerity. I asked him again to tell me the story, and he began by saying, "My father was a British officer stationed in the Punjab of India, where we made our home. When I was 16, he financed a friend who went to South Africa to try his luck in the diamond mines, but my father never heard from him afterward. The year I was 20, a tall, handsome stranger, a man of great wisdom, visited my father at our home. He had come to bring a message from father's friend. 'I bring you news,' he explained, 'from the friend whom you financed 4 years ago. He met with great success on that venture, in fact, became very wealthy. He has recently passed on at the mines and left no relatives. His entire fortune has been left to you, and in case of your passing, it is to go to your son. If you desire, I will take charge of the matter and have it transferred at once.' 'I cannot leave India at the present time,' my father said, 'for I am on government duty here. I appreciate greatly your offer to take care of the matter for me.' I was standing nearby during their conversation, and when they had completed arrangements, the stranger turned to me. 'My son,' he said, 'when you find the man who will offer you a crystal cup of sparkling liquid, you will have met the one who can assist you in raising the body. I cannot tell you more than this, except that you will find him on a great mountain in North America. This may seem vague to you now, but it is all I can say.' The stranger left, and a month later my father, who had written out to adjust certain government matters with the natives, was shot and passed on before he could be brought home. I was an only son. And after another month, mother and I prepared for our return to England. Just before we left, the same stranger came again and said he was ready to transfer father's fortune to me. I explained father had been shot. 'Yes,' the stranger replied, 'when I left 2 months ago, I knew your father would pass on before my return. I have arranged for the fortune to be transferred to you, or rather to the Bank of England for you. Here is money you may wish to use on the journey home, also the papers of transfer and the credentials you will need at the bank. Present them, and you will receive custody of your wealth. Much of it is in diamonds of the first quality. I thanked him, and offered to pay for his services, but he replied, "Your kind intent is greatly appreciated, but that is already adjusted. I will be happy to accompany you to the steamer at Bombay." The trip revealed to me his great wisdom, and beside him I felt like an infant. I know now that he enveloped me in a radiation which has stayed with me throughout the years. He arranged for transportation, accompanied us to the boat, and his last words to me were, "Remember the crystal cup. Seek, and you shall find." After a most wonderful voyage, we arrived at Southampton, went on to London, and presented my credentials to the Bank of England. The official to whom I presented them remarked, "Yes, we were expecting you today. Here are your bank and checkbooks." I looked at them to see how much my fortune amounted to, and was amazed to learn £100,000 had been placed to my credit. 5 years later, my mother passed on. I transferred one half of my wealth to a bank in New York and began the search for the man with the crystal cup. I can never repeat the disappointments, the trials, the sorrow I have been through, but in the face of everything, somehow I could never give up. The thing which seems so strange to me is, while I have grown old in outer appearance, my energy and strength are as great as ever. Sometimes I think greater than in my fullest youth. In years I am 70. Today I just wanted to follow this trail, and praise God I have found you. My desire was so great it was almost irresistible. "But my good man," I asked, "what am I to do for you?" "You will know," he replied, "for I know I have made no mistake. In the heart of this majestic mountain is a great power. I feel it. Ask God to show you what to do." Suddenly, I felt the mighty God power surging forth so strong, it almost lifted me from the ground. Making the sign Saint Germain had taught me, I called to God for light, and raising my hand in salutation said, "Mighty God, in man and the universe, we seek thy light, we seek thy wisdom, we seek thy power. Let thy will be done in and for this my brother, who has sought and found me to do for him I know not what. Thou knowest. Manifest thy will through my mind and body, and let whatever is to be done for this brother, thy son, come forth." As my hand came down, it held the crystal cup, filled with living liquid light. I offered it to him, and my mighty God self spoke again, "Drink without fear, thy search is ended." He drank the contents without a moment's hesitation. I stepped forward quickly, and took both his hands in mine. Slowly and steadily, every vestige of age disappeared from him, and the God in me continued, "Behold, thou art forever free from all earthly limitation. Ascend now unto the great host of light who await thee." Very slowly he began to rise from the ground, and as he did so, his human garments disappeared, and he became clothed in raiment of glistening white. I let go his hands. Then, in a voice of deepest love, he said, "I shall return to thee, beloved brother. Well shalt thou be repaid for this transcendent service. Thou wert the only one through whom this could be done for me. Some day thou shalt see why." And with a happy smile, he disappeared on a radiant pathway of light. As the mighty God power within me receded, I was so astounded, I fell on my knees and offered the deepest prayer of my life in grateful humility and praise for the privilege of giving such service. I rose, and the Master Saint Germain received me into his wondrous embrace. "My beloved brother," he said, "I am greatly pleased. Noble and faithful was your attendance upon the great God within you. Beautifully did you receive your mighty God in action. I do indeed congratulate you. You will ever be held within our embrace, even though outwardly you may not always be aware of it. You have become a worthy messenger of the great white brotherhood and the ascended host. Hold close to your mighty God self. Thus you will ever be ready for service wherever and for whatever is required. My love enfolds you until we meet again. I will keep you informed." Slowly, I wended my way back to the lodge, every step praise and gratitude to the one mighty God that molds us all into eternal perfection.